Welcome on this beautiful day for the next lecture on virtual machines. So last time you heard the last call, which we tried to optimize. So here I display for you again the scheme which I propose for the translation of such a last call. And you see it looks almost as like the translation, the generated code looks almost like the code for an ordinary call, in that we evaluate the arguments in the order from right to left. Then we evaluate the function by using code V to get the hold of the function, which we then want to apply to the arguments. And then we have the apply. And the only thing which is different from an ordinary call is that there is no mark in front. That's the first part. So I mark it, I indicate that by this black box up here. That mark we have abandoned. And also, we have inserted a new instruction, namely this move instruction in here. So maybe that is positive on the positive side, so this is marked red. So this is the new thing. Now this marking, removing this mark instruction is in so far a little bit problematic, because the mark contained the continuation address. The address where to continue when the application has been finished. Now, why don't we need this continuation address? Yeah, recall the instruction which was there, which we have cancelled out, was mark A, and this A was the first address after the call. Yes. There is already a continuation address in the current stack frame, which we reuse. And this is also the continuation address for the last call, because we directly continue there. So therefore, we do not need another address. And therefore, we can really not only save these three memory cells, we also do not have to care about the continuation address, because that is known. So this is good news. So really we have saved something there. There's a little bit of a bad news here. This move instruction is a little bit complicated, because you recall that we had the slide instruction, and that's copied one value a few memory cells downward onto the stack. And here it is a little bit different. Here we must think of that we have some data on top of the stack, and then we put kind of the content of the new stack frame on top of it, and then we have to slide the whole block downward, and we have to squeeze out the locals which are no longer needed of the surrounding call, and we have to squeeze out the actual parameters of the surrounding call, which is also no longer needed. Therefore, this is a kind of sliding of several memory cells. That I have called it a move instruction. Yeah. So here is the move instruction. Perhaps let us have a look at that. So here are the K memory cells to be moved. These ones, and then there is the number of cells which is to be squeezed out. This is this R thing. So this is the number of cells to be deleted. And then everything shifts down, and the ordering and everything is the same. Now let us again look at how this how the code looks then for this piece of code. So this is the function. So if there were a let rec in front, this would be a tail recursive implementation of the reverse function. You know, there's a Taylor recursive version of the reverse function where you kind of have two arguments. One is the accumulator, one is the real argument, and then you kind of take one element out of the list of the real argument after the other and put the element on the other pile, if you like. So you have two piles, and then you put one the elements from one pile to the other until this pile is empty, and then this pile contains the same elements as the first pile, but in reverse ordering. This is the idea. And so here is this is the function definition to implement that, and we see here. So we check the implementation goes as follows: we check the argument. The first argument, the first pile, for emptiness. If it's empty, everything has been put onto the second pile and we return it. And otherwise, there's a first element which we put onto the pile and continue with the rest. And this is a tail recursive call here. So to indicate that, here this is a tail recursive call, and we may wonder how it is translated. So therefore, let us see how the body of this function is translated, say, with a call by neat semantics and in VCode. The VCode for the function body, this is the thing which is wrapped into the F object for the for this function R. So, maybe one more thing we should write down: what is the address environment in which we translate this R thing, this the body of the body of the function? Well, there is a global variable. Which one is the global variable? This is this R thing, yeah? So R is mapped to G0 because it's the only global, and we start indexing with 0. And X is mapped, so this is the first argument, so this gets the relative address L0, and Y gets the relative address L-1. So that's the... this is the thing how we, that is the role. Now let's see how the code looks like. So the function body, so there are two arguments, therefore test arg2. Then we have to push the X. So the X is a local relative address 0, stack distance 0, 0, minus 0, 0, therefore push log 0. We evaluate it, and then comes the match expression, and there we have the the testing of the list is going with that, then together with the jump B. Yeah. So between A, these two instructions is the case for the nil, for the empty list, and for the empty list we have to return the value of the Y. So at that point, the stack distance is 1. Y has relative address minus 1. 0 minus minus 1 is 1. Therefore, push log 1. We evaluate it, and that's it. Yeah. Now, in the case of constructor, a constructed list, a non-empty list, the H... Now I can again print it down here. The H is mapped to what is the stack distance? The stack distance is at the moment before the test arg thing before the whole thing. We have stack distance 0. So therefore, before the match expression, we have a stack distance 0. Therefore, the H receives, is a local with relative address 1, and the T is something a local with relative address 2. So that allows us now to define what does it mean to, now we come to the green part, which we have to translate, and the green part is translated, the translation of the green part is this part. And following that, the code for that green part, we would have to give up the space for the locals and continue. On the other hand, we will never reach the this location. We will never reach this location. Why? So in this sense, I can kind of make a thing. Why will we never reach it? Because the call, the green part is a call, and this call will take place within the stack frame of the surrounding call. And the surrounding call, there is the this is the call of the whole the call to R. So that will be outside. So this the first place where this R is called. All other this will kind of store in the stack frame the continuation address, and this is the place where we will go to. Yeah. Once we are done with it. Okay. So now. Now let us look in detail. This instruction here, this final one, where will it be jumped to? It will be jumped to only from after we will arrive at that instruction only from there, because the slide 2 will never be will not be reachable, but this jump B will arrive at this return 2. So in some sense, an optimizer could kind of find out return 2 is only reached by this jump B, and we could replace the jump B directly with return 2 and remove, by that, optimize the code further, if we like. But the standard translation scheme would not detect that. Now, let us look at this green part. What do we expect for it? So that is kind of the translation of this green last call. So this means the first thing which we have to do is to provide the second argument, the h cons y. And we have to provide C code for it. Now, C code for a list, we said we do it like that. We do C code for the components and then make the list constructor. Now the C code for the h is a variable, is just pushing the reference to the variable. This is there. And the same for the h. This should be here. And then we construct the list. This is the cons. So note, due to our little optimizations of this code C scheme, we do not construct any closure here. And that is good news. Yeah. So in this sense, the code is not so bad. So now let us see why pushing the h is push log 1. So h, we said, is relative address 1. Current stack distance is 2. Therefore, 2 minus 1 is 1. So therefore, it's 1. Now for the y, we said, is has relative address minus 1. Stack distance is 3. 3 minus minus 1, 4. Okay? So this is really the h and the y, and then the cons constructs the second argument. Okay? So this kind of is the second argument. Now it remains to construct the t. So now the stack distance has decreased because cons has removed two references and pushed one. So therefore, we now have stack distance 3. And then we have to push the T. T, we look up, has relative address 2. 3 minus 2 is 1. So therefore, push log 1 gets the T. And we see now we have the two arguments. Now comes the R. The R is a global, and we push it as a global and on top of the stack. We are not sure whether it has been evaluated before, so therefore whether it is a value or just a closure. Therefore, we trigger this eval, and now the data for the last call are on top of the stack. Now we have to move them down. What does it mean to move them down? We have to squeeze out the all local data and the two parameters. The local data at that point in time is, what is it? The local data is the H and the T, and this is 2, and the two parameters, this is 4. So this means we have to move to squeeze out 4, and we move down 3 things. So therefore, move 4, 3. And then we do the apply. Okay? So that's the last call. Okay. So the move we had. And so that's the last call. And that's already... that, in some sense, finishes all the standard optimizations of the which we apply to this functional machine, and also, And you see here these minor things that we kind of pushed the closures a little bit inside, allowed here to remove a lot of closure construction, because often expressions are built like that. You have variables, and on top of it, just a constructor, or just a tuple, and inside variables are constants. And that is the thing where we will not construct closures at all. So by that, closures then really, really will be confined to expressions where you have a function application, or where you have complicated lets or so, where perhaps this closure thing is more or less inevitable. Okay, so that was this. Are there questions? Okay, so then we let's go to the exceptions thing. This is a new thing. I think in the original version of the slides it was not there, but I have updated the slides several times. Even the current version should be on the in the net, and. So because we recall that at some point when we discussed C, we at some point said that modern languages provide the concept of exceptions for irregular control flow. And that is to identify. And so it's not there in C. They have this weird concept of long jumps. It is present in C++. And it is present in functional languages. And the simplest way how to deal with it is perhaps in functional languages. So I have extended my OCaml dialect with exceptions. And so let us see here an implementation of a perhaps probably to you very well-known function. This is also one of these standard examples. At least I like it very much. This greatest common divisor calculation. Why? It is a recursive function. You have to do some non-trivial computation, and still you only compute with numbers. So that is a rare event. Usually when you want to do non-trivial computation, you cannot do it with numbers. You need data structures. But here you can do something, and it is, at least I find it a little bit, still, although it's a very old algorithm, still an amazing thing. The way how you usually get it presented is by displaying this one. You check whether the arguments are equal, then you return one of them. Otherwise, you check which one is smaller. So, for example, if the y is smaller than the x, then you subtract the y from the x, and and call the GCD function again. And you see here, this is a tail recursive function. So it's the last call. The recursive call is the last call, so this will be translated. Although we have it's a purely functional program, it will be translated into a loop. So this is, in this sense, it's nice. And the other way around, if it's the other way around, that is x is less than y, then you subtract it from y. And that is kind of the usual thing, because in our mind we have that GCD is always called with positive numbers. But it is unsafe. There's no reason. So the data type of integers has negative numbers and has zero. What will this function do with negative numbers? Or if one of them is zero? For example, if y is zero, then you subtract y from x, and x is positive. So you subtract y from x. And so the value of x has not changed. And so this will not terminate. So this function is very is in this sense a bit brittle, and you have to do extra actually if you want to have a safe function. You better should make clear that the everything is fine. Actually, in the way I have written it, one would not do it. So you see, so the first thing is this red thing checks whether everything is fine, and if things are not fine, then raises an exception. So that is that in itself is nice, and then we would kind of we raise the exception, and then outside, we raise the exception, and then outside the whole call is in a within a try something, and a try block or so. So it's a try is the keyword, and it takes an expression. And when an exception is raised inside this expression, then this expression will be this exception will be caught, and here will be handled. So this try with construct is provided by OCaml. This corresponds to this try-catch thing in Java. There's a little bit of there are two things to be noted about here. The first thing here, I allow to raise exceptions of any type. So this is not the case in OCaml. In OCaml, you have a dedicated type exception, are only allowed to raise exceptions. So that's the first thing. The second thing here, this program is inefficient in this sense. Why? This is true. So the better, it's exactly as you say. The better way would be to have a worker GCD function which does not check its arguments, but is only called inside the real GCD function, which is not recursive, and only checks the arguments whether they are proper, and then calls the function, and if not, it does something else. Then we would also not need the exceptions. So in this sense, it's a bit odd. And why is it so? Because even when the function, if the GCD function at the beginning is fine, the arguments are fine, then they stay fine during the whole process. So they do not get nothing gets wrong here. So in this sense, it's a little bit a contrived example, I admit. But you can write it down like that. Okay? So now, what do we do? So what do we expect? So in principle, we could think of that we have when we kind of have such a try, expression, and then the width clause behind, then this means this expression in between is evaluated and at some point may raise an exception. At some point. And so, now what should happen if the exception is raised? Then the current computation is cancelled and the current stack frame is blown away and the control returns to this place. Yeah. So in between here, in this case, this will not happen. But in principle, the expression here might have allocated an arbitrary amount of extra stack frames on top of the stack, because you might have gone deeply descended into some kind of recursion, and then only in the very end you find, oh, something is wrong. And then you kind of have to roll back the whole stack until you come back to the until you jump back outside of the yellow expression. And in order to do so, we somehow have to establish kind of we have to freeze somehow all information which is required for continuing with the width and then continuing afterwards. How can we do that? And so for that, one idea, and since we have allocated a lot of things on the stack, we need to know where to return if an exception is raised. So in order to do so, we kind of introduce a fresh thing, which is an exception pointer. So this is just a new register, which points to the current place where to go when an exception is raised. And also, we kind of collect all information which is necessary to continue at that place down there, and that means we install an X like for a function call. We also allocate an exception frame on the stack when we enter a try block. So at the try, we will establish a stack frame, and when we raise an exception, we will return to that stack frame. Or we will use this stack frame to continue the computation at the outside. So now what kind of information should we provide inside the exception frame? So the first thing is we need to know where to go when an exception is raised. So that means we have to know this one here, the code for this expression. So this must be sitting somewhere. This is a code address. We can't recall it. We have not stored it somewhere else. So this is the place to store it. So this is the negative continuation address. And then we need, so this expression E2 has global variables, and we kind of have to know what is the global vector at that place. So that is, we have to store the global pointer, and we have to store the frame pointer. For that expression, so that we can kind of take up the computation as from before. So these are kind of all the old information which we need, and also moreover, what we also need is the what we need is the old exception pointer, because we could have several we could we could at the moment be at the evaluation of a try expression, and then inside again enter another try expression. So that means once we jump out of the inner try expression, then the expression pointer must be updated to the outer expression pointer. So this pointer also must be updated, and therefore we have to record the old expression pointer inside the expression the exception frame. So that's it. So now, therefore, consider such an expression. So this is the prototypical thing. What do we have to do? So the first thing is we have to allocate, I said, before entering into the evaluation of E1, we have to allocate the expression frame. So we currently have no possibility to do how to do it. So therefore, we kind of invent on the spot, right away, invent a new instruction. This is this try instruction. Yeah? And that is meant to allocate the, to store the relevant information on top of the stack. Okay? And then we have established the exception frame. Then we can proceed with, no, I perhaps do not like to do it in this way, but I make it in the, in yellow, then we proceed with the with evaluating expression E1, and that is, since everything here is code V, so we will use code V for the E1. And note that the stack distance has increased by 4, because we allocated 4 things on top of the stack, namely the negative continuation address, the old stack frame pointer, the old global pointer, and the old exception pointer. So these are 4 informations. Therefore, stack distance plus 4. Now, once we are done with it, when we reach this location, what does it mean? This means that we successfully evaluated the E1. If we successfully evaluated the E1, nothing went wrong. There was no exception raised. The allocation of the stack of the exception frame was superfluous. We can pop it. Yeah. So that's the we can pop it, and this is done by this new instruction: restore B. Restore. And what is the B? B is the address where we will continue if everything went nicely. So we will just go there. That's it. Yeah? So this is kind of the normal mode of the normal mode when no exception has been raised. Now what happens? Now we also have to generate code for this other piece, namely this E2. So this E2, note here, perhaps I did not discuss it in very great detail. So here is a variable. The width has a variable. This variable will be bound to the value thrown when an exception is raised. Yeah? The exception is raised with a value. This value will be thrown up into the air, and at some place, it will come down again and will enter this variable x. And by this variable x, the expression E2 has access to the value which has been thrown. So this is like in the catch clause in Java. There you also have an exception E, and then you introduce your favorite variable name, and then this E thing receives the thrown object, and this is the value E. And then you can do with it whatever you like. You may inspect it, you may do pattern matching on it, you may compute with it, you may just throw it again or do something else with it. And that's the same here. So in the sense, it's quite similar, although it's very, very primitive. Okay, so but this yellow part also must be taken care of, and the start address for the code for the yellow part, this is A. And this has been recorded inside this exception frame, so that one knows where to go when an exception is raised. So here is the A. And now what will happen at that place? So the first thing is that we hope that the variable x has been provided. The value for the variable x has been provided, and where? On top of the stack. And on top of the stack means on top of the exception frame. So therefore, the stack distance then is considered as what? Well, there was the on top of the try. Yeah. Now I wonder a little bit whether the stack distance is plus one. Yeah. So, but I guess it's okay. So we assume that when this E2 is evaluated, the exception, the frame has been removed. The exception frame has been removed. The global vector has been reinstalled. The frame pointer has been reinstalled. Everything, and the so that we when we enter there, everything is in the same mode, if you like, so that we have still available this this row and the stack distance, only that now an extra element has been allocated on top of the stack, namely the x, and the row prime records that there is not only the variables in row, but additionally there is this x. And it sits on top of the stack, so it, therefore it's a local with stack distance, with a relative address stack distance plus one. Yeah? So that is the attention, and then we execute the E2. And so we generate code for executing the E2. And once it is done, what then should happen? Well, the local X is no longer needed, so it is squeezed out. But the value which has been computed is the value of E2. And this is slided down by 1. So therefore, this instruction. And then we continue with B, which is the first address after the E. Yeah, so everything is fine here. Now, what is still missing is what happens at the race. Here, so that before going there, so this is a kind of mysterious thing still. Now, what happens here is what happens at the try. So try, we said, we allocate all relevant information on top of this. Record all relative information on top of the stack, and this means we take the collection of all these three current registers and put them as a block on top of the stack. That's it. And then additionally on top of it, we push the negative continuation address, the thing where the code for the exception is, this is this A. So in that sense, we realize that this trying is not so complicated. The more complicated thing is, the more complicated thing then will be the race. But now for the moment, let us think of the restore. This was the other, going back here. So this one we have, this one we now proceed to. So this is the restore. So what happens at the restore? At the restore we kind of pop off the stack frame because it was no longer needed, and just return the value which we have computed by evaluating the E1 and continue with B. So this is the restore. Therefore, does the following. Here is the value which we have computed. On top of this sits on top of the stack frame, which we for the exception handling, and from that we only kind of take off this information, which we place inside the exception pointer, because the now we have finished this dry block, and we kind of the current dry block is now the outermost dry block, and therefore we have to restore the old exception pointer. And additionally, we have to take that value which we have computed and put it on top of the stack. That's it. And that's it. And also, we have to take the B and put it into the PC. So these are the three operations which we have to do. And otherwise, yeah, we have to pop the stack. Okay? So it's not so complicated operation. We only have to keep track that we have to make sure that we don't forget anything. So that was kind of the normal mode. Now comes the raising of exceptions. That is, the expression looks as follows. It's just that. Now, the raising of exceptions, what do we expect to do? Well, the first thing is we have to evaluate the E clearly in order to have at hand the value which we want to of the exception to be thrown or to be raised. And then so this kind of gives us this part of the code. And then we have to do a lot of other operations, namely to give up the current computational context, go back to the current exception frame, reestablish the pointers there, and jump to the negative continuation address. So these are the things which we expect from to be done here. And so this is a complicated operation. We have no idea how to do it. So therefore, we invent an instruction. So this is our standard way out. Yeah. So that is now here we see what computation must be done. So this before the raise instruction on top of the stack is sitting our favorite value. So this is the value which we want to have on top of the stack at the end of the evaluation of the race. So therefore here I kind of put it into this auxiliary variable A for later use. So then what else? How do I find the current exception frame? So this is completely easy. For that I have my fabulous pointer XP. So I go there and I find there all information which I need. I find the A, which I must put into my PC. I find these three registers, which I have to put into the registers. And then I don't need this stack frame anymore. That means I can just pop it and write the A on top of it. These are the operations, and I hope I have implemented it in the right way. So the stack pointer here is set to XP minus 3. So this means I have it is to the three elements are popped away, and then I put at here I install the PC, here I recover the old FP, here I recover the old GP, here the old XP, and then I only have to put the value A in the right place, and that happens here. So you see it's just a little bit of calculating with these registers, and that's it. So in that sense, it's also a surprisingly simple operation, which kind of blows away a huge portion of the stack in one go. So I may speak aside that when you do a similar thing in C++, it is not as simple as that. Does anyone know why?
Ja.
That's the key point, because there are a lot of objects sitting on the stack, and when an object is destroyed, and by that they may be destroyed, and when you destroy an object, you have to call the destructor. That is the way of the rudimentary way of support for memory management or garbage collection provided by C++. So therefore, it's there for this unwinding or this blowing off of the stack is not a simple operation in C++, but an expensive one, but an important one also. Okay. Is there a question here? So then let's see for the GCD how that would look like. The GCD function, so where is it? Here is this GCD function, so it's a recursive function. So for the recursive definition, we would have to do an alloc 1, because it's just one function which we allocate. Then we have to provide we have to implement this, the right-hand side of for the GCD. So this is a funval object, so it is created here. So there's one global, namely the global GCD, which is put into a vector, and that is has relative address 1. Currently stack distance is 1, so therefore push log 1. Then now we have this created the right hand side created the F object for the GCD. And inside, so here now comes the, here we jump across the code for the GCD function. And you see here, I was a little bit lazy. I have skipped the implementation of the function. And now after the function, we would override the dummy closure, the dummy memory cell of the recursive definition, and continue with the main body of the let rec, which is this try expression. So this try expression, so that is now that is the thing where we might concentrate on. It starts here and hopefully gets to the end. gets to the end. I guess the end is here, because the slide one in the very end is to squeeze out the alloc one, so the recursive definition of the GCD. So this is for the try block. So what do we see here? The first thing is we have to install the try block, and then it contains the address where to continue when everything. Where to continue when something goes wrong. So this is the C. The C goes for the exception. What happens when the exception is there? Then the expression inside this try expression. This is the call for the GCD 4, 0, and 5, I guess, and that is an application of an application. So therefore, we have to mark something, and the D is the first address after the first address after the function application. So therefore, this is the end of the try expression, so that is the place where which we would reach in case that in case that no exception has been raised. So in between there is the code for a call, and we see here we have to get the second argument, which was a 5, the constant 5, load constant 5, make basic. Then the first argument, which was the constant 0, therefore load constant 0 and make basic. So these are the two arguments which are provided. And I guess there's something missing. There's one instruction here missing, namely the pushing of the function to be called, and that would be which one? The current stack distance is 10. The local, it was the first local, so the GCD is mapped to L1, so therefore 10 minus 1 is push lock 9. 9 must be inserted here in this place. And then we can do the apply. Okay, and now afterwards comes the call. There could be an exception raised inside the call, and in this case it will. But in case nothing is raised, then we would execute this restore instruction, and this restore instruction needs the continuation address where to continue after the try block has been finished. So therefore it contains the address for the first instruction after this the whole thing, which is this is where the local variable GCD is thrown out of the stack. So this is this last slide. So now it's the only thing which remains, and I kind of throw away all the things, is this part here. This is the code for when the exception is raised. And in that situation, we have no longer the exception frame. We have only the look on the stack. We have the local variable for GCD and another variable, which is the I think it was the variable set, which takes the return value from the the exception value. And now this variable set has relative address 7 is mapped to a local, and it below that is only the GCD which was GCD, I guess that was L1, and this one is L2. Set is L2, and therefore we have 2 minus 2 gives 0. Therefore, we push log 0 will push the value of C on top of the stack, and then slides by 1, and by that computes the value of set and returns it, and as the value of the expression. So that is the full code. In principle, this push log 0 and then slide 1 again could be optimized away. So since if you return the exception value directly, you could just do nothing there and everything would be fine. But this would be the yellow part would be what the code generation schemes would provide us with. Yeah, that's the story with the exception. So it's not so, besides that I made the mistake in forgetting the function here before for the apply. It was in some sense a straightforward application of our ideas how to implement things like that. So whenever we introduce a new context or kind of have to return to a computing context, we have to store all relevant information about this context in the stack frame. And that is, in some sense, this long jump thing is there. You also kind of have the C provides you with the functionality to encapsulate the current calling, the current computing context in some and store it in a struct somewhere in the heap or on the stack and then return to it. So in this sense, it is from an implementation point of view quite close. Okay, is there a question concerning to this exception thing? So I will kind of make the modification in the in my famous slides and put them again online. Yes?
We do not have a last on anymore, right?
What do we do not have?
There's no last on anymore.
So let us go back to the code and wonder whether this is a last call, and the answer is it is. So this this is no longer a last call, yes, because you have to keep there is something outside and which you have to or is this the last call?
I mean the recursion, it's not table recursive anymore. We have this mark construct after that.
Yes, I wonder where the so this is the last. This here is clearly a last call, which you can evaluate in the same call, in the same context as this one.
Yes, but
this, the other one, is not.
We did not translate it as one. In the last part where we handled the exceptions.
No, I didn't show you the code for this one. I didn't show you the code for that. I only showed you the code for that. And there is. There.
Shouldn't in the driver also the call for the GCP?
Once again?
Shouldn't in the driver in the call segment, shouldn't there also be the call for the GCP in the loop? I mean, you only load the picture on the device and then you just return it.
What do you want to change here in this code? So here is this is the code for the GCD function. The load what? Once again.
Load the function at all. I mean, you want to evaluate it, but it should still be in the driver.
The function is not loaded on the stack.
Yeah.
I do not understand. What is the problem, once again?
Well, after load C0, I can make base. You want to...
yeah, I said, here the...
Here,
that is what I have inserted by hand. So here you have to load the reference of the function, and then you only can do the apply. So this is a mistake in the code here. So the code is wrong. It would fail terribly because it would find a basic object on top of the stack and then to call the apply, which would be... It would explode. So there's a... Yeah? Was that your question?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there was a push. What did we say? Push log 9. Okay, so here once more reminding you that in OCaml exceptions have their own data type. And here the pattern, the handler was in a very simple way. We only provided the variable which takes the value. In OCaml, the handler is kind of try and then you with, and then you can have, like in the match expression, you can list a lot of constructors and do case distinction on the various exceptions. And if the exception is not matched, then you just thrown again. And also, there's one more thing that in OCaml, some of the exceptions are raised by the runtime system. Well, this I have not yet here discussed. So in some sense, what happens by a division at a division by zero? Then one would kind of, for that, OCaml provides built-in exceptions with some kind of value which are raised. And then you can also catch these runtime exceptions which you have not, which have been raised by the runtime system and not by yourself. And that is an extra functionality which any of these languages provides. Java provides it and any other language also. And this is since these runtime exceptions typically will not have the same type as your int exceptions or whatever I used in my GCC example. This means that is one of the reasons why they provide this extra data type exception, which by that they can kind of, so it's a uniform thing, and they can use it for their runtime exceptions, and you can use it by defining your own exceptions. And that is also an interesting extra thing, since this data type, this is in OCaml, it's the, I guess, more or less the only data type which is extensible. So there are some predefined exceptions, but you can define new constructors for the same data type. And you can, every module may provide its own exceptions. That is an, so this is, in some sense, a lightweight exception context concept compared to the Java concept, where you have this classing and subclassing and a heavyweight hierarchy of throwables and errors and this type and that type, and you have to do a lot of subtyping and things to get an exception value. And so here it's just the constructor which you define, not a new type or a subtype or whatever. And then another very important point is silently, I have shown you only in the example the case in an OCaml style, for an OCaml style language, which is call by value. So it's not for a call by need. Why? Yes, that's true. So in that sense, one has problems, yes?
But we could put the exception in the closure itself as the exception for an expression.
If you can guarantee that the race is, that whenever a race is executed, the corresponding exception frame is on the stack, then we can do it. And we can, there's certain syntactical restrictions under which we can adhere to in order to enforce it. And then we could kind of do it. Otherwise, we have a problem. Yeah, it's just, for example, if the race is inside a function argument, and this function argument is passed around, and then stored in a data structure, and then forgot in the data structure, the stack changes somehow, and then later is evaluated. Well, then things are, might be, this, then it's kind of scope, escaping from the scope that would be possible by means of closures. We could kind of, but then how to continue and what to do with the value? Because the value then computed by the exception handler would not provide an alternative value for the closure, but for some surrounding thing which has long gone, and we long assumed that everything went right. So therefore, it does not make sense, much sense anymore. Okay, so this finishes the functional part, and we may proceed to a new to a new continent of programming languages, namely to the Prolog world. So this is, who has ever written a little Prolog program? So there is a non-empty set. So let's see. So our little language here is has a little bit of problematic name. So it is a Prolog Lite. So it's so what does it mean? So for OCaml, for the functional part, we kind of concentrated on essentially all features of OCaml, but in a simplified syntax, and we took the freedom to rule out certain things which we found not so important at this, on the spot. So now here the same thing we will do for Prolog, and that means we concentrate on the kind of the innovative and new things. So, and that is the rule-based programming. That is what we would like to understand and to know how to implement. We do, in that respect, we find arithmetic a minor feature, and also the thing with the cut operator. So the arithmetic, I guess maybe we do it in exercises or so because it's easily added, and the cut operator we will look at later. And what also we will kind of rule out is self-modification. And that, because there is something like metaprogramming in Prolog, so that you can construct your clauses and rules dynamically. So that is, you can do a little bit of computation, and then you can construct new clauses and assert them. And henceforth, you will have these to take care of these clauses as well. So this would mean as if you kind of dynamically would create a new function in C, and then later call it, or remove a function which was there before. And so you will never, no longer have it at hand. So things like that are possible in Prolog, in real world Prolog, and we kind of ignore that because it's not so. And then there's also something like that you can kind of construct, generate variables, construct terms, and things like that, which is kind of a little bit also like reflection. Which we also will not look at. That means while these things we will rule out forever, the other two are in principle not so outside of the world. We will deal with that. Okay, so now for you who have no experience with Prolog, here is a simplified Prolog. And also shows a little bit of the format which we will adhere to make code generation easier. So this little program solves a very important problem, namely the question whether an elephant is bigger than a dog. So if you don't know that, you may write this program and you will get the answer on the spot. So what is it? So for that, I think hidden in it is something like transitive closure. Now, what is it? So you may state facts. And now I write the real Prolog syntax here on top of it. So you may write facts like that. The elephant is bigger than a horse. Yeah, and then you have in the real syntax, you have to make sure that you have a full stop at the end of a fact. And so this here is then the predicate name, and it holds for these particular arguments. So that's a fact. And also you have to make sure that the predicate names are small, not capital, and here these, what they call atoms, these are also in small letters. Start with a small letter. So, and in this sense, you see here somehow a little bit of a distinction. So this is a predicate name. And these two things are names of what is an atom? So this is a constructor somehow. And just by writing it down, you have it. So you don't have to declare data types or things like that. You write down, you want to have an elephant, and you have it immediately. So this is nice in some sense. So it also indicates that there's no types. So therefore, it's an untyped language in some sense. Okay, so now how did we write that down? Well, the predicates for us are so something like procedures. So they have, therefore, formal parameters. And so the formal parameters are sitting here. And parameters are in capital letters. Variables, like parameters, are in capital letters. So this is another. So therefore, this is kind of a different. So, and now you here say, okay, that bigger holds for X and Y if X is an elephant and Y is a horse. So in that sense, these what I have written here directly into the parameters, the parameters are always parameters, and here I write the assumptions about the parameters. And there I can write such like an equality, X equals elephant, Y equals horse. Okay, so that's kind of an equivalent notation, which you can use in real prolog also. Clearly, you still have this dot. I think this full stop I have simply omitted because I found it a little bit superfluous. And the other thing is I have this left arrow. And so prolog likes this ASCII art thing. And so these left arrows are like that, a double colon and a stroke. That's it. Yeah, that is the left arrow, which I have always will have here as a left arrow. So now you see that. Sorry for all the scribblings. Let me get it away. So once again, so this tells us that. Sorry. This tells us here that an elephant is bigger than a horse. And here this states us the fact that a horse is bigger than a donkey. And here also that a donkey is bigger than a dog. Here's even some more things. There's also a monkey around. And this also the donkey is bigger than a monkey. Okay. So now this was facts. So in some sense people also call it, in the old days when they were very enthusiastic about it, they called it a knowledge base. So you have now knowledge. And now you can draw consequences out of your knowledge and make deductions. So deductions is, these are rules, so now you provide rules, and if the premises are satisfied, then the conclusion can be deduced. So you have a real strong deduction, and now you can create new knowledge. You have knowledge and you create new knowledge if you want to be ideologically enthusiastic and so on. So now what is a rule? A rule is that you have, we have this arrow notation already. This is the consequence. This is the assumption. So this means, if X is bigger than Y, it satisfies the bigger predicate, then it also satisfies the is bigger predicate. So I could also have, it's kind of a bit contrived that I use this is bigger predicate there, but it would make it a little bit more efficient. Practically, but in principle, I just could add also, if I remove this is thing, then this is kind of superfluous, and I would have the extra clause, X is bigger than Y, if there's some Z around, so that X is bigger than Z, and Z is bigger than Y. So this is the rule for transitive closure, yeah? Map reduce problem.
I mean, this statement,
it looks for you like
XC and bigger CY. So it has to, if I want this example, it has to map the ones between somehow. So
It splits up, yes, but you so maybe there is an implementation which you could do by means of MapReduce. But here we are in a sequential context, so that it does not pay off. But the question is how one does one implement such kind of thing, because we don't know what X is, so we want, in this sense, we want to perhaps know, get, so the question is what is, so this is kind of just declarative. It tells us what kind of conclusion we might draw. The question is, what do we do with these rules? So we could take the point of view, we just explore the world of knowledge and deduce all facts which are valid. But that is dangerous, because in particular here it's always with atoms, so this is in a closed world, if you like, and there are things you might kind of enumerate all possible facts and kind of find the subset. And that is at least in principle possible. But if later on we will use composite terms, and then we cannot deduce all facts. So that makes us a little bit wonder what these rules are good for. And there comes in this last thing, so that we will not infer all possible facts, but we will ask a particular fact and want to know whether this holds. Yeah? So we want to know, is an elephant bigger than a dog? And now we ask the system to provide us a proof for it. That is, how can a proof be? Either you find a fact which matches the statement, or you find rules by which you reduce this fact to other facts which hopefully are easier to prove. So everything goes now boils down to proof search. Yeah? And from our compiler we expect to translate this list of rules together with the query into a sequence of instructions which performs a proof search and provides us with an answer. Okay. So that was with this very trivial example, and I guess any textbook on Prolog which you open will start with such a stupid example. So I like this example for some other reason, not for the animals. Also, I like animals, but this is also a particular important dialect of Prolog. This is data log in some sense, where you only have these atomic values, and data log is not so completely at some point. So I don't know who of you has learned about data log somewhere. So sometimes in database lectures they mention it. It was at some point people were very enthusiastic about data log because they thought of it as the next generation SQL. Because predicates you could kind of infer, could kind of equate with tables. And by that you can relate things, like you can kind of identify certain tuples which should be in relation. And that is what you have in a database as well. So you only have to, instead of atoms, also allow numbers to be stored and strings, and more or less that's it. And then you can code a database entry to a database fact as such a fact, and then you can have a collection of facts. This is your database, and you can ask queries about it. And there you also have kind of, and in some sense, what is this kind of, what kind of operation is this in terms of databases? It's a join. Yeah? The join operation, you kind of join the two relations, bigger and is bigger. Now, here's only one minor difference, that this is a recursive definition. And so this is a deductive database in some sense. And it's because in SQL you do not have recursive definitions of predicates as we have here. But there are extensions, and I guess all these commercial databases, they provide you with the possibility to define something cursively. I think they have it, or I'm no database expert, you know it. Okay, they have it, so they have learned of this feature, and but then I guess, I'm, since once again I'm no database expert, at some point Datalog was dead, because the traditional databases just added this little bit of recursion, and then people were so enthusiastic about SQL, nobody cared about Datalog anymore. So, which is a little bit sad, and but still, these rule-based, if you like, data languages, they are still around in various disguises. For example, there are rules. I think even some of these XML standards speak about rules, how to specify rules and do deductions, and they. For access control and so in the security area you also have to specify all kinds of policies, who is allowed to do what and under which conditions, and they write rules in some sense in a similar way as the old data log guys have done, and which is in some sense, once again, this is a subset of this Prolog thing. Okay, now comes perhaps... going beyond this data log thing to where you have larger values, not just atoms, but structured terms, structured values. And the natural thing there is to have lists. And so one list is, one thing what you can do with lists is we had this append function. Now in OCaml you have functions, but in Prolog you do not have functions, you only have predicates, and predicates are relations. So this means in order to express that when you want to append one list to another, you should define a ternary predicate. Like this one, a ternary predicate. Here is it. And it the idea is the first two arguments, the first two components of the predicate provide the input, and the third one the output. And then you define this input-output relation. So, but you can only deal with relations. So this is, once again, the key message. You have only the predicates correspond to relations, and you do not have this functional programming, but you have a relational programming. So therefore, in principle, this means that it is even not so clear what is the input and what is the output. So, for example, if you have this ternary predicate of append, then you could specify parts of the input and parts of the output and ask the system to fill in the details. Yeah? To fill in, to provide an argument X and part of the second argument Y, so that the concatenation of it is the list A, B, and then something. Yeah, and the third element set. And yeah, so that's kind of, in this sense, this Prolog has amazing possibilities, which are not there in functional languages, for example. Now, let us once again write down here here I again use that I want to have dedicated variables for the purpose, so kind of like formals in the head on the left hand side, and on the right hand side I write conditions for these for these parameters. So in real Prolog one would write the first statement like, what would one write it? One would write it like that, and then one would write this fact. Yeah? This would be the correspond to the first clause, and the second clause would look like X is of the first parameter is of the form, is of the form, it has a head, and then some rest, and then there is a Y, and then the result starts with a head, and then with some set prime under the assumption. So here again, this funny symbol to indicate the right, the left arrow, under the assumption that x prime and y and z prime are in relation. You see the syntactical transformation which I have done. Essentially, I have just taken these things, these two things here, and inserted them for the x and for the z. Yeah, I put the explicit equality thing into the head. But for cogeneration, it will be much more convenient to, once again, to have this format down below. Also, it's just a syntactical transformation. But these are, if you look up once again, I have written down this format here. I've written up for you once again this format here, because this is the way how you will see it in the Prolog program. Okay? So for the one more thing which I forgot about the concrete syntax, here you would have question mark and then this again, this stroke, and here also a full stop afterwards. Okay? So perhaps you are again a little bit confused, because now why do I have this strange other syntax of lists? Because before we had this OCaml lists, which were separated with semicolons, and now the OCaml the people in the Prolog people prefer another syntax, and that is this one. And I'm sorry for it, but I have not invented it. It's that's what they use. So the empty list looks the same, but then they, instead of having this infix operator, they have a distfix operator, which looks like that. Brackets in front, brackets behind, and then this vertical bar to separate the head and the tail. Sorry for that. And if they want to enumerate the elements of a list explicitly, then they use a comma-separated list and not the semicolon. We can't help it. Okay? So that's just the convention. Is there any more questions or doubts about this program? Okay, so then let us here see what the let us kind of agree upon how the syntax of our programs will look like. So the syntactical entities which we have are terms, are goals, are clauses, and programs. And terms are either atoms, so just a thing, a name, small letters, no capital letters. Then, no capital in the beginning. Later on, you may have capital letters. Or you have a variable, which I write always with capital letters. So actually, variables could be either this one, x, y, or x, a, I don't know, _7, this also would be a variable, but you could also create, so in Prolog syntax, everything which starts with an underscore is also a variable. So underscore AB is a variable. Yeah. Okay, and please note, variables are part of terms. So also when the Prolog program returns a term, it may still contain variables. So this is something novelty, which we in no other program you will be able to return variables. But here you may return variables. And we will kind of think a little bit what that means later. Then there's this underscore thing alone, just one underscore. This is the anonymous variable. In some sense, in real Prolog, you might also have seen that, that if you have some pattern variables and you are not interested in these variables, you just write underscore for it, and then the system will just ignore it. Yeah. So this is here also an important thing in the Pollock world. And then you have these constructive terms, then you write F around something, and that is then F then by that is declared at the first use, and then you have it. Yeah, it's a data constructor. Then perhaps we go, then what is a goal? That is something which might occur, for example, here on the as a premise in the rule, as something which must hold in order to draw the conclusion. And we have two kinds of goals which one might which might occur, either such a unification goal, such a, with something with an equality, this one here, that a variable x equals a term. So variable x equals another variable, x equals donkey, or x equals some more complex thing. And so this t might contain variables. And the other form is a literal, like that, what people call literal. This is that a predicate followed by terms. So in this sense, this here is a literal. It is a predicate up applied to terms. Now in this case, variables. But it could also be more complicated terms. And there could be several of these literals in the body of a clause. So now I have explained to you this one. Sorry. I have to explain to you the terms, the goals, the clauses, and perhaps one more thing. What is a program? It is a set of rules, a set of clauses, followed by one query, which is a goal or a conjunction of goals. And that's it. And that is all what a Prolog program is about here. And let us stop here, and we continue then with that next week. Thank you very much.